Chapter 3. Ever since the Boadicea had made her landfall, all hands had been in a state of feverish activity, putting the last touches to her beauty. Now it was almost over, and she stood into False Bay with a fair breeze rounding her stunsails and wafting the reek of fresh paint along with her. The only stage still to obscure her spotless black-and-white Nelson checker was that occupied by the carpenter's mates, applying carmine with anxious care to the lips, cheeks, and bosom of the opulent though insipid British Queen. Jack, already fine in his best uniform, stood by the starboard rail of the quarter-deck with Mr. Farquhar beside him. A little farther forward, the gunner blew on his slow match by the brass 9-pounder. All the other guns were housed, ranged with the perfection of the guards on parade, their breaching pipe-clayed. Seymour was a conscientious first lieutenant, and the deck was a pleasure to behold, the gleaming pallor of the wood, the ebony of the seams new-paid with pitch, the falls precisely flemished, a series of exact helices that no man dared disturb, the few pieces of brass the captain would permit blazing in the sun, no speck of dust to be seen from stem to stern, the hencoops, the surviving swine struck down into the hold together with the goat, which, in the general silence, could be heard bleating angrily for its long-overdue tobacco. The general silence, for all hands were on deck in their Sunday frocks, and they gazed earnestly, mutely, at the shore upon which people could now be seen walking about. Walking about on dry land among trees, most of them perceptibly black. The only sounds to be heard, apart from the goat, were the bark of the master conning the ship from the forecastle, the ritual answers of the timoneer, the chant of the leadsman in the chains. By the mark 15, by the mark 15, and a half 15, by the deep 16, and a half 15. And the conversational voice of the captain as he pointed out various objects to his guest. That flat rock's what we call Noah's Ark, and far over there is Seal Island. The doctor'll like that. And beyond the ark, where you see the white water, is the Roman rock. We shall pass between the two. Indeed, we shall open Simon's Bay at any minute now. Mr. Richardson, pray see if the doctor's finished, whether he can come on deck. He'd be sorry to miss all this. Yes, there we are. He went on with his telescope to his eye as the inner harbour came into full view. Raise a knob, do you see? The two-decker. Then Sirius. Nereid laying inside her, a very pretty berth. Then a brig I can't make out at all. Mr. Seymour, what do you make of the brig with her topmasts on deck? At this point Stephen appeared, blinking in the strong light, wiping his bloody hands on a woollen nightcap and looking squalid. "Ah, there you are, Doctor," cried Jack. "Have you finished sawing up poor young Francis? How's he coming along? Prime, I dare say." Francis, until today the most popular topman in the ship, endeavouring to gild the Boadicea's main-to-gallant truck, had lost his hold, making a most spectacular fall from that giddy eminence, missing the deck and certain death, by the grace of the frigate's roll, but grazing her number 12 port lid with such force as to play havoc with his thoracic cage, and above all to smear the bleeding paintwork, the grass-combing bugger. "He may do," said Stephen. "These young fellows are made of steel and a particularly resilient leather." "So, that is Africa." He looked greedily at the shore. The known haunt of the aardvark, the pangolin, the camelopard, of birds without number, roaming at large amidst a flora of extraordinary wealth headed by the ostrich. And that, pointing towards a remote headland, is the all-dreaded Cape of Storms itself, I make no doubt. Not exactly, said Jack. The Cape is far astern. I'm sorry you didn't see it. We came round precious close while you were busy. But before that you did see the Table Mountain, didn't you? I sent a messenger. Yes, yes, I felt most obliged to you, in spite of the unchristian hour. It might also be compared with Ben Bulben. Curious, ain't it? And now here on the larboard bow... No, the larboard. You have Simon's Bay, a sweet anchorage, and there's Razor Knob wearing the flag. Would that be a line of battleship? Asked Farquhar. A most imposing vessel. I doubt any 64 will ever lie in the line nowadays, said Jack. In any case, the Razor Knob was built 50 years ago, and if she fired a full broadside, she might fall to pieces. But I'm glad she looks imposing. Then comes Sirius, a much more powerful ship, in fact, although she has but one tier of guns. 36 18-pounders, much the same broadside weight of metal as ours. Then another frigate, do you see? Nereid, 36, but only 12-pounders. Then that odd little brig of war. "Pray, sir, why are they not at sea?" asked Farquhar. "As I understand it, those and a smaller vessel called the Otter are almost all we have to guard the Indian trade. I ask out of mere curiosity." "Oh," said Jack, "this is the tail end of the hurricane season up there. They could hardly be blockading the Mauritius in the hurricane season. They're probably in to refit and to take in stores. Nothing for them up there, 2,000 miles to the north. Mr. Johnson, I believe you may begin to reduce sail." His eyes were fixed to his glass. The Boadicea had made her number, and he was watching for the master attendant's boat to put off. There it was, just leaving the pier. Although the frigate was now under fallen main topsails alone, still she glided in, heaved on by the moderate southeast swell and the making tide, and the shore came fast towards him. The moment he had the Admiralty House square on, he would begin his salute. And while he waited for that moment to come, he had the strangest feeling that at the first gun England and his whole voyage south would vanish into the past. "Carry on, Mr. Webber," he said, and as he spoke the 9-pounder bawled out its respects with a tongue of fire and a cloud of smoke. "Fire one," said the gunner, and the echoes came hurrying back from the mountains. "Fire two, fire three." By the 17th gun the great bay was alive with crossing reverberations, and before they died away a puff of smoke appeared on the Razor Knob's side, followed a second later by the deep report. 9 guns she fired, the reply due to a captain, and after the 9th the Boadicea's signal midshipman, young Weatherall, piped, "Flag signalling, sir." Then his voice broke as he went on, "Captain, repair aboard flag." "Acknowledge," said Jack. "Lower away the gig. Where's my coxswain? Pass the word for my coxswain." "I'm sorry, sir," said Johnson, blushing. "Mooden's drunk." "Damn him," said Jack. "Crompton, jump into the gig. Mr. Hill, are these all my papers? Every last one?" Clasping the packet of sealed, canvas-covered documents to his bosom, he ran down the side, caught the heaving gig on the height of its rise, and said, "Shove off!" It was many, many years since he'd last been here. A midshipman, an oldster, in the Resolution. Yet how exactly he remembered it all! There were a few more civilian houses in the village at the bottom of the bay, but everything else was just the same. The steady beat of the surf, the mountains, the men-of-war's boats crossing to and fro, the hospital, the barracks, the arsenal. He might himself have been a lanky boy returning to the Resolution after catching Roman fish off the rocks. He was filled with a pleasurable excitement, with countless memories, yet at the same time with an apprehension that he couldn't define. "Boat ahoy?" asked the Resonab.
"Boat ashore," replied the acting coxswain in a voice of brass, and then more quietly he said, "Row them all."
The gig kissed against the tall flank of the flagship. The side boys ran down with their scarlet man ropes. The boatswain started his call, and Jack was piped aboard. As he took off his cocked hat, he realized with a shock that the tall, bowed, white-haired figure who answered his salute was the Admiral Bertie he'd last seen in Port of Spain as the lithe, lively, wenching captain of the Renown. And some part of his busy mind said to him beneath all the rest, "Perhaps you're not so very young yourself either, Jack Aubrey."
"Here you are at last, Aubrey," said the Admiral, shaking his hand. "I'm very happy to see you. You know Captain Elliot?"
"Yes, sir. We were shipmates in the Leander in 98. How do you do, sir?"
Before Elliot could reply with anything more than an extension of the friendly smile that he'd worn ever since Jack's face appeared, the Admiral went on, "I dare say those papers are for me. Come along, let's have a look at them in the cabin." Splendour, opulence, carpets, a portrait of Mrs. Bertie looking plump and comfortable.
"Well," he said, wrestling with the outer covers, "so you had a tedious passage of it, but did you have any luck on your way down? They used to call you Lucky Jack Aubrey in the Mediterranean, I remember. God damn these seals."
"We saw barely a sail, sir. But we did have a little brush off the dry salvages and retook the old Hyena."
"Did you? Did you indeed? Well, I'm heartily glad of it."
The papers were free now, and as he glanced through them, he said, "Yes, I've been expecting these. We must take them along to the governor at once. But you have a politico aboard, I see, and Mr. Farquhar. He must come too. I shall send my barge by way of compliment. You can't be too careful with these political gents. You'd better order some cool clothes, too. It's a 20-mile ride to Cape Town. The governor will not object to nankeen trousers and a round jacket." He gave his orders and called for a bottle of wine. "This is the right diamond of the year one, Aubrey," he said, sitting down again. "Too good for you young fellas, but you did retake the old Hyena. I was a midshipman in her." "Yes." His washed-out blue eyes looked back over 45 years, and he observed, "That was in the days before carronades." Returning to the present, he drank his wine, saying, "I trust your luck'll hold, Aubrey. You need it on this station." "Well, and so we shall have to fag over that damned mountain, a wearying ride in this infernal dust. Dust everywhere, rain or shine. A whole nation of swabbers would never come to an end of it. I wish we didn't have to go. If it weren't for the political side, I should get you to see the minute you had your water aboard. The situation's far worse than ever it was before you left England. Far worse than when these orders were written. The French have snapped up 2 more Indiamen, this side of the 10-degree channel, the Europe and the Streatham. Homeward-bound Indiamen worth a mint of money."
"Lord, sir, that is very bad," cried Jack. "Yes, it is," said the Admiral. "And it's going to get even worse unless we bring it up with a round turn, and smartly at that. That's what we must do. It's feasible, and it must be done. Oh, yes, it's feasible, with a certain amount of initiative. And maybe I should add good fortune, too, though luck don't bear talking about." He touched wood, considered for a while, and then said, "Listen, Aubrey.
Before your Mr. Farquhar comes aboard, before we start getting entangled in political considerations, I shall lay the position before you as clearly as I can. There are 4 French frigates based on Mauritius and Reunion, in addition to the force they had there last year. They can use Port Louis or Port Southeast in Mauritius and St. Paul in Reunion, and separately or in pairs they can range out as far as the Nicobars and beyond. The whole Indian Ocean. You can't catch them out there. We can't convoy all the Eastern trade. We don't possess the ships. And you can't blockade them forever. So you must either destroy them in detail in their home waters, or eventually you must take their bases away from them. Now, with this in mind, we've seized and garrisoned Rodriguez with part of the 56th and some Bombay sepoys for your water in the first place, and in the second as a base for the reinforcements that are supposed to come from India in time. There are only about 400 men on the island at present, but we hope for more next year. It's a question of transport. You know Rodriguez? Yes, sir. I've not touched there, however. Rodriguez. A remote and tolerably barren speck of land alone in the ocean, 350 miles eastward of Mauritius. He'd viewed it from the masthead of his dear surprise. So, at least you have your water. As for ships, you have Boadicea, of course. Sirius, with a good steady captain in Pym, as regular as a clock. Nereid, she's only a 12-pounder and getting on in years. But Corbett keeps her in very good order, though he is rather undermanned. Otter, a fast, useful 18-gun sloop in very good order, too. Lord Clonfert has her. She should be in any moment now. And I can let you have Raisonable, except in the hurricane months, where she can't bear a hard blow. She's not all she was when I was a boy, but we careened her a few weeks ago, and she's quite fast. At least she's a match for the Cannonier, who's older still. And she makes a show. I might conceivably be able to add the Magician from Sumatra in time, and the Victor, another sloop. But even without them, I conceive that Raisonable cancelling out Cannonier, 3 well-worked-up frigates and a powerful sloop wouldn't be reckoned out of the way for dealing with 4 Frenchmen. Certainly not, sir, said Jack. The Admiral was speaking as though Jack's pendant were a certainty. No one will pretend it's an easy task, however. The Frenchmen are Venus, Manche, Caroline, it was she who took the last 2 Indiamen, and Bellone, all new 40-gun frigates. As for the rest, they have the Cannonier, as I've said, still mounting her 50 guns, our brig, the Grappler, several avisos and a few smaller things. And I warn you, Aubrey, if you hoist your pendant, I cannot let you have a captain under you. If you shift into the Raisonable for the time being, Elliot can replace you in the Boadicea, but I cannot let you have a captain under you. Jack bowed. He scarcely relied upon it. On the remoter stations there were few post-captains to spare. And then again, if a commodore did have a captain under him, that commodore was entitled to a third of the admiral's share of prize money. "May I ask whether we have any intelligence of their land forces, sir?" he said. "Yes, but I wish it were more exact. On Mauritius, General de Caen has the best part of 2 regiments of the line, and his militia may amount to 10,000 or so. Our information from Reunion is more scanty, but it seems that General de Brulé has much the same. That's a tough nut to crack, I grant you, but cracked it must be, and at the earliest possible moment. You have to strike hard and fast with your forces concentrated while theirs are dispersed. In a word, you have to go in and win. Government will be no rare old taking when the news of the Europe and the Streatham reaches England, and this is the kind of situation where you must produce results at once. I don't mention the country's interests, of course, but I do say that from a purely personal point of view, there's probably a knighthood, or even a baronetcy if you succeed. And if you don't, why, it's the beach and half pay for the rest of your life. A midshipman darted in. "The captain's duty, sir," said he, "and should you wish a compliment to the gentleman in the barge?"
"Certainly," said the admiral.
As to a flag. In the pause that followed, he gazed abstractedly at his wife's portrait. "Should you not like a baronetcy, Aubrey?" "I'm sure I would. Mrs. Bertie fairly longs to wipe her sister's eye." The unofficial part of Simonstown, though little more than a hamlet, had drinking booths, wine shops, and places of entertainment enough for a town of moderate size. And into one of these, at dusk, walked Stephen Maturin, bearing a bunch of orchids. He was tired, thirsty, and covered from head to foot with African dust. But he was happy, having spent his first half-day ashore, walking up a mountain, clothed with a vegetation largely unknown to him, and inhabited by remarkable birds, some of which he recognised from their published descriptions. He had also seen three quarters of a female spotted hyena, and he found the remaining piece, including its wistful face, removed to some distance, in the act of being devoured by his old friend, the bearded vulture. A pleasant combination of the present and the past, of two far distant worlds. He called for wine and water, mingled them in proportion to his thirst, placed his orchids in the water jug, and drank until at last he began to sweat again. Apart from the landlord and three pretty Malay girls at the bar, there were only two other people in the twilight room. A very large officer, in a uniform he couldn't make out, a vast, gloomy man with a great deal of dark whisker, not unlike a melancholy bear, and his smaller, inconspicuous companion, who sat at his ease in shirt sleeves, with his breeches unbuttoned at the knee. The sad officer spoke a fluent, though curious, English devoid of articles. The smaller man's harsh and grating accent was clearly that of Ulster. They were discussing the real presence. But he hadn't made out the thread of their discourse before they both burst out, "No Pope! No Pope! No Pope!" The sad officer in the deepest bass that Stephen had ever heard. At the bar, the Malay girls politely echoed, "No Pope!" And as though it were a signal, they brought candles and set them about the room. The light fell on Stephen's orchids and upon the contents of his handkerchief, 14 curious beetles, collected for his friend Sir Joseph Blaine, formerly the Chief of Naval Intelligence. He was considering one, a bupestrid, when he became aware of a darkness by his side, the melancholy bear, gently swaying.
"Golovnin, Fleet Lieutenant, Captain of Imperial Majesty's sloop Diana," said he, clicking his heels.
Stephen rose, bowed, and said,
"Maturin, Surgeon of Britannic Majesty's ship Boadicea, please to take chair." "You have soul," observed Golovnin, nodding at the orchids. "I too have soul. Where did you find them? Flowers?"
"In mountain," said Stephen.
Golovnin sighed, and taking a small cucumber from his pocket, he began to eat it. He made no reply to Stephen's proffer of wine, but after a while he said, "What is their name, flowers?"
"Lisa Grandiflora," said Stephen, and a long silence fell.
It was broken by the Ulsterman, who, tired of drinking alone, brought his bottle over and set it on Stephen's table without the least ceremony.
"I am MacAdam of the Otter," he remarked, sitting down. "I saw you at the hospital this morning."
Now, by the light of the candle, Stephen recognised him, not from that morning, but from many years ago. William MacAdam, a mad doctor with a considerable reputation in Belfast, who had left Ireland after the failure of his private asylum. Stephen had heard him lecture and had read his book on hysteria with great applause.
"He'll not last long," observed MacAdam, referring to Golovnin now weeping onto the orchids.
"Nor will you, colleague," thought Stephen, looking at MacAdam's pallid face and bloodshot eye.
"Will you take a wee drink?"
"Thank you, sir," said Stephen. "I believe I shall stay with my negus. What is that you have in your bottle, pray?"
"Oh, it's a brandy they distilled hereabouts. Raw rot-cut stuff. I drink it experimentally, not from indulgence. He," pointing an unsteady finger at Golovnin, "drinks it from nostalgia as the nearest to his native vodka. I encourage him."
"You alluded to an experiment," said Stephen.
"Yes. Strobinius and others allege that a man dead drunk on grain spirits falls backwards. On brandy he falls forwards. And if that's true, it tells us something about the motor centres, if you understand the expression. This gentleman here is my corpus vile. Yet it's wonderful how he holds out. This is our third bottle, and he's drunk glass for glass with me."
"I honour your devotion to science, sir."
"I don't give a fart in hell for science," said MacAdam. "Art is all. Medicine's an art, or it's nothing. Medicine of the mind, I mean. For what is your physical medicine apart from purges and mercury and bark? What your murderous chirurgical tricks? They may with luck suppress symptoms, no more. On the other hand, where is the true fons et ergo of 9/10 of your vicious constitutions of the body? The mind! That's where it is," he said, tapping his forehead. "And what heals the mind? Art, nothing else. Art is all. That is my realm."
It occurred to Stephen that MacAdam was perhaps a somewhat seedy practitioner of this or any other art. A man, furthermore, whose inward torments were clearly printed on his face. But as they talked of the interaction of mind and body, of interesting cases they'd seen, false pregnancies, inexplicable remissions, their experience afloat, the inverse relationship of constipation and courage, the proved efficacy of placebos, his opinion of MacAdam rose. Indeed, a mutual esteem came into being, and MacAdam's arrogant, didactic tone grew even civil. He was telling Stephen about his patients aboard the Otter. Most of the Otters were, sensu stricto, mentally deranged, and there was one case that MacAdam would describe and name, were it not for professional secrecy, a fascinating and particularly subtle chain of symptoms, when, without any warning, Golovnin fell off his chair grasping the orchids. He lay motionless, still in the attitude of sitting. But he fell sideways. A wholly inconclusive result. At the sound of the crash, the landlord paced to the door and whistled. Two enormous sailors walked in and murmuring, "Come, Vasily Mikhailovich, come, little father," they carried their captain out into the darkness. "He has not hurt my flowers, however," said Stephen, smoothing their petals. "They are in their essentials quite intact. You have no doubt remarked the curious spiral convolution of the ovary, so typical of the whole order, though perhaps your realm doesn't extend to botany at all?"
"It does not," said MacAdam, "though twisted ovaries are well within it, and twisted testicles too. I speak in figure, you understand. I am jocose. No, the proper study of mankind is man. And I may observe, Dr. Marchalin, that this eager prying into the sexual organs of vegetables on your part seems to me..."
What it seemed to Dr. MacAdam didn't appear, for his tide, too, had now reached the full. He rose, his eyes closed, and he pitched straight into Stephen's arms, falling, as Stephen noted, forwards. The landlord brought one of the wheelbarrows that he kept under the porch, and with the help of a black, Stephen wheeled MacAdam towards the pier, passing several bodies of cheerful liberty men as he went. He hailed each party in turn, asking for any otters, but no man chose to leave the sheltering darkness and sacrifice a moment of his shore leave, and Stephen heard nothing but facetious replies, "Otters bound for the Rio Grande. Otters paid off at the Nore. Otter was broke up for firewood last Wednesday week." Until he met a group of Nereids. A familiar voice cried, "It's the Doctor!" And there was the powerful form of Bondon at his side. Jack Aubrey's coxswain from his earliest command. "Bondon, sir. Do you remember me?"
"Of course I remember you, Bondon," said Stephen, shaking his hand. "And I'm delighted to see you again. How do you do?"
"Pretty spry, thank you, sir. And I hope I see you the same. Now just you shove off, darkie," to the black. "I'll take care of this here barrow."
"The question is, Bondon," said Stephen, giving the black 2 stuvers and a penny, "the question is, how should I find the means of conveying my charge to his ship? Always supposing that his ship is here at all, which seems to be a matter of some doubt. He is the surgeon of the Otter, Bondon, a learned man, though somewhat original, and at the moment disguised in drink."
"Otter, sir? She come in on the turn of the tide not 10 minutes ago. Never you fret. I'll square our boatkeeper directly and take him out."
He hurried away. A little later, the Nereid's jolly boat appeared at the step, and Bondon carried the body into it. In spite of the dimness, Stephen noticed that Bondon moved stiffly, and this stiffness became more apparent as he pulled out across the harbour towards the distant sloop.
"You're stiff, Barrett Bondon," said Stephen. "In another man, I should say he'd certainly been flogged. But that can scarcely be the case with you. I trust this isn't a wound or a rheumatism from the falling damps."
Bondon laughed, but without much mirth, and said,
"Oh, it was 4 dozen at the gangway, all right, sir. And 2 more for luck. Brass on the lock of the No. 7 gun not bright enough."
"I am amazed, Bondon. Amazed," said Stephen, and indeed he was.
Bondon had never been flogged to his knowledge, and even in a flogging ship 50 lashes was a savage punishment for anything but a most serious crime.
And grieved.
"Let us row over to the Boadicea, and I shall give you some salve."
"It's all right now, sir, thanking you kindly. I was aboard you this afternoon, but it wasn't for no salve. You'll find the letter we wrote a-laying there in your cabin."
"What is it all about, Tell?"
"Well, sir," said Bondon, resting on his oars, but by this time they were close to the larboard side of the Otter, and in reply to her hail, Bondon called, "Your doctor coming aboard, request a line." The Otter was perfectly used to this,
A whip with a bowline appeared over the side. Bondon slipped it under McAdam's arms, and the surgeon vanished upwards.
"Well, sir," said Bondon again, pulling slowly towards the Boadicea, "this is the way of it. When me and Killick on the Leeward Island station heard the captain was afloat again, we went to join him, in course. And there was plenty more in other ships did likewise. Old Sophies, old Surprises, even an old Polyquest, Bolton, that slab-sided cove the captain pulled out of the sea. Oh, was he the new commissioner ship he'd have no trouble finding a ship's company? Not like some." He swallowed the coarse expression with a cough and went on. "Howsoever, we put in our request, and Captain Dundas, a very affable gent and a friend of the captain's, as you know full well, sir, discharged us into Nereid, Captain Corbett, for the Cape, which he was so kind as to say he was sorry to lose us and give Killick a pot of guava jelly for the captain. But Nereid's short-handed. Because why? Because the men run whenever they can. There was Joe Lucas of Armis, as swam 3 mile with bladders off St. Kitts, sharks and all. Was brought back, flogged, and swam it again with his back like a raw steak. And today, when only 12 Liberty men out of the whole crew, 2 of them are off for the mountain in spite of all them wild beasts. I know for certain fact, leaving 38 months' pay and their prize money. So, you see, we're afraid, Killick and me and the rest, that Captain Corbett will not discharge us into the Boadicea. And so we wrote this letter to you, sir. Because, not liking to put ourselves in the captain's way, being that he's to hoist his pendant any minute, as they say, and therefore too busy, we hope you might put in a good word, just casual, at the right moment."
"Of course I shall. But you could very well have addressed Captain Aubrey himself. He has the kindest recollection of you. Often speaks of his real coxswain and much regrets your absence."
"Does he, though?"
said Bondon with a chuckle of satisfaction. "But even so, we take it very kind in you to say a word. It would come more proper-like from you. And we're main anxious to be out of Nereid. She's not altogether a happy ship, I collect." "No, sir, she ain't." He rested on his oars again, and looking a little sideways at Stephen, he added, "She's a shot-rolling ship, that's what she is." Stephen knew nothing about the sailing of ships, theoretical or practical. But he did know that when a crew started trundling cannonballs about the deck under the cover of darkness, then something was very much amiss. For the next stage was mutiny. He also knew that in any normal ship it would be unthinkable for an unusually steady, sober man like Bondon to be flogged.
"I'm not complaining, mark you," said Bondon, "nor I'm not setting up in judgment. There's some right bastards in the Nereid before the mast and elsewheres. And when things reach a certain pitch in such a ship, the cat falls on the just and the unjust alike. I can take 50 lashes as well as the next man, I hope. Though I may say as how it was the first time the cat and me came acquainted. Oh, I was beat like a drum when I was a little chap in the Thunderer, but that was only the master-at-arms admonition, as we say. His cane, sir. Now, what I mean is that in the first place, me and Killick and the rest want to get back to our own captain, and in a second we want to get out before things turn nasty. And at the gate they're going now, well, I shouldn't give much for Captain Corbett's life, nor some of his officers come in action, or even maybe a dirty night with no moon, and we want no part in it."
"Ugly, Bondon, very ugly," said Stephen. And no more until they were alongside the Boadicea, when he said, "Good night now, and thank you for rowing me home." He turned in with Laguard's voyage, with its fascinating account of the solitaire, and Sparman. And late in the middle watch he heard Jack come aboard. But it wasn't until quite late in the morning that they met, Stephen having been called to the sick bay to deal with an alcoholic coma that had suddenly started to gush blood at the ears.
And when they did meet, it was clear to him that both his crapulous night and his crapulous morning, the sick bay had smelled like a distillery, were to be prolonged. Captain Aubrey had the yellow, puffy look of one who was drunk far too much. So much, indeed, that his 20-mile ride back hadn't worked it off. 20 miles? More than 20 miles on a damn screw that flung me down 3 times and spoiled my best nankeen trousers, he said. His steward had broken the coffee pot. His French cook had gone ashore with Bretonnier to join the other prisoners of war, and never more would there be brioche for breakfast. But infinitely more than even the missing coffee was the fact that the Admiral had promised Jack his orders and had not produced them. An interminable, inconclusive conference with the Governor, Mr. Farquhar, and 2 general officers of a stupidity remarkable even for the army. Then an equally long supper with the soldiers, determined to make their guests drunk. And all this while, no orders. By the time Jack set off on his glandered mare, the Admiral had long since gone to bed. The flag lieutenant knew nothing about any orders written or even contemplated. So here he was, as he told Stephen in the cabin, not knowing where he was. There'd been no word about his pendant at any time. So here he was, left hanging up in the air. Perhaps the expedition wouldn't take place at all. And if it did, after months of delay, perhaps he was not intended to command at all. There'd been a furtive, evasive look in the eye of the Admiral's secretary, an ill-looking, untrustworthy swab, for all he was a parson. There'd been no mention of higher command in his original sailing orders, and although the Admiral had certainly spoken as though the matter was settled, the appointment no doubt lay at his discretion. The Admiral might have changed his mind. He might have been influenced by the opinion of the Council. And then earlier there had been that ominous, if you hoist your pendant. "Let's take a turn on deck," he said. "My head seems to be made of hot sand. And, Stephen, might I beg you, implore you, not to smoke those vile things in the cabin? It's your pothouse all over again, like that soldier's mess last night." They reached the quarter-deck in time to see an odd figure come up the side. A young man dressed in a gaudy coat and a little gaudy hat. He'd come up the starboard side, the officer's side, and as he advanced towards Mr. Seymour, he saluted. The first lieutenant hesitated. Not so Jack. "Turn that fellow off the ship," he roared. Then, in a lower voice, holding his hand to his aching forehead, "What the devil does he mean by it? Prancing about the deck of a king's ship improperly dressed like a jack-pudding." The young man got into a boat and was rowed away by a crew of Merry Andrews, all in much the same kind of rig. Jack Steward cautiously sidled near, muttering something about the gunroom's pot, and Stephen said, "I believe he means that coffee's up." It was. And as they drank it, benignity returned, helped by fresh cream, bacon, eggs, pig's fry, the last of the true French short bastards toasted, and Sophie's orange marmalade. "I'm sorry I was so cursed snappish just now about your cigar," said Jack, pushing back his chair at last and undoing his waistcoat. "Pray smoke, Stephen. You know I like the smell." "Aye," said Stephen. He broke a cigar in 3, crumbled one piece, moistened it with a few drops of coffee, rolled it in paper, and lit it with a voluptuous indraught. "Listen now, will you?" he said. "Bonden, Killick, and some others are aboard the Nereide and wish to return to you. All tastes are to be found in nature, we are told, and it is to be presumed that they like the brutal, arbitrary, tyrannical exercise of power." "Oh," cried Jack, "how very, very pleased I am. It'll be like old times. I rarely regretted anything so much as having to part with them. But will Corbett ever let them go? He's devilish short-handed, and it's only a courtesy, you know, except to a flag. Why, a man like Bromden's worth his weight in gold. Corbett does not seem to be aware of his value, however. He gave him 50 lashes.
Flogged Bromden? Cried Jack, going very red. Flogged my coxswain? By God, I...
A nervous young gentleman brought the news that the Commander-in-Chief's flag lieutenant had been seen putting off from the shore, and the captain of the Otter from his sloop, and that Mr. Seymour thought Captain Aubrey might like to know.
"Thank you, Mr. Lee," said Jack, and he went on deck.
Lord and Lady Clonfert had been far, far from his mind, but they came back with a rush as he saw the Otter's gig, pulled by the same Mary Andrews of just before breakfast, approaching the Boadicea. It was at about the same distance as the Raisonnable's barge, but the flag lieutenant paused by the flagship to exchange a bellowed and apparently very amusing conversation with a friend on her poop, and before it was over the gig was alongside. Clonfert was piped aboard, a slight, strikingly handsome, youthful-looking man in full uniform, with a star on the bosom of his coat, and a singular expression of expectation and uneasiness on his face. He flushed as Jack shook his hand, saying, "I'm happy to see you again, Clonfert, and I heartily wish I had better news for you. Come into my cabin." Once there, he went on, "I'm very much concerned to tell you that because of an unfortunate misunderstanding about the time, I was obliged to leave Plymouth without Lady Clonfert."
"Oh," said Clonfert, with a look of bitter contrariety on his mobile face. "I was afraid that might be so. I sent early to inquire, but it seems that the message I sent by one of my officers couldn't be received."
"An officer?" cried Jack. "I had no notion an officer in that rig."
"I am sorry it didn't meet with your approval, sir," said Clonfert stiffly. "But it is my custom to dress my gig's crew in my own colours. It's usual enough in the service, I believe. And the gentlemen under my command fall in with my humour. I confess it is irregular, however. Well, can lead to misunderstanding. Still, it's cleared up now, and I've delivered my damned unwelcome news. I regret it extremely, but I'm sure that Lady Clonfert will have taken the next Indiaman. She will have travelled in much greater comfort, and she should be here within the next week or so, for we made but a slow passage of it. You'll dine with me? We have a sucking pig, and I recall you was fond of sucking pig in the Agamemnon." Clonfert flushed again at the name of the ship. He darted an intensely suspicious glance at Jack, and then, with an artificial air, he said he must beg to be excused. With infinite reluctance he must plead a previous engagement. About that, in taking his leave, he must be allowed to express his sense of Captain Aubrey's great politeness in having intended to bring Lady Clonfert to the Cape. He was pénétré. He brought it off well enough to make Jack, whose conscience was far from easy on that score, feel something of a scrub. And if he hadn't tripped on his way out of the cabin, the performance would have been well nigh perfect. The flag lieutenant was already on deck, talking and laughing with Seymour, when Jack saw his visitor to the side. And Jack's searching eye saw that the jolly young man was the bearer not of the unimportant, inconclusive, temporizing verbal order that he had so dreaded, that he had so reasonably dreaded from the tone of last night's conference, but of an important folder bound up with tape. Red official tape. In the cabin once more he received the folder.
But first he had to listen to the flag lieutenant's message. The admiral desires me to say, sir, that he was taken unwell just after the meeting, that he was unable to give you your orders as he had intended, but that he dictated them from his bed at the earliest possible moment. In fact, sir, he dictated them to me, the secretary not being in the way. So you know what's in them, I dare say. Yes, sir. And may I be the first to wish you joy of your pendant, sir. Thank you, Mr. Foster, said Jack, with the full sun lighting up his heart and bowels, his whole being. Thank you very much indeed. I trust the Admiral's indisposition causes him no pain or distress. I could wish him restored to the most amazing health and happiness immediately. The flag lieutenant thought that perhaps the admiral had eaten something. For his part, he had recommended a dose of rhubarb. And Jack listened to him with an appearance of steady, solicitous attention. Jack looked decently solemn, but his mind was swimming in happiness, a happiness made all the more wholly concrete, real and tangible, when the flag lieutenant's recollections of an occasion upon which he, too, had eaten something came to an end, and Jack could cut the tape and see that his orders were addressed to Commodore Aubrey. Yet underlying this pure felicity there was another level of consciousness, a hard, sober determination to come straight into direct contact with the real thing, to see exactly what it amounted to gauge the limits of his possible initiative, to weigh up the forces in presence, and to start dealing with the situation at once. The orders were clear, concise, and urgent. The admiral had obviously had his way. Commander Aubrey was directed and required to repair aboard the Raisonnable, to hoist his pendant, to take the ships and vessels named in the margin under his command, to proceed to sea with the utmost dispatch, to seek out and destroy the French cruisers operating south of 10 degrees south and west of 70 degrees east, and with the cooperation of the officer commanding the land forces on Rodriguez, which were to be reinforced at the appropriate juncture, to undertake the reduction of the French possessions of the Ile Bourbon, otherwise Ile de la Réunion, otherwise Ile Bonaparte, and of the Mauritius, otherwise Ile de France, together with that of the French ships and vessels in the seas thereto adjacent. He was to attend to the general directions in the attached schedules A and B, and in all political matters, or those having a bearing on contact with the civil population, he was to seek the advice of William Farquhar, Esquire, His Majesty's Governor Designate, and, in the absence of Mr. Farquhar, then that of Dr. Stephen Maturin. The schedules, together with various appreciations, charts, hydrographical notes, and estimates of the French strength, mostly derived from the American merchantmen that passed to and fro, were in separate packets. And among them was a paper bearing the superscription, Lieutenant Johnson, Royal Navy, Boadicea. "What's this?" asked Jack. "The Admiral has confirmed your acting order for Mr. Johnson," said the flag lieutenant. "It's his commission." Jack nodded, a fresh jet of pleasure overcoming the underlying gravity for a moment, and the flag lieutenant went on, "I am also to say, sir, that the Admiral desires you will use your own discretion entirely as far as Raisonnable is concerned, and shift your pendant just as you see fit. He knows her condition only too well. He asks for this list of followers and servants to be sent to him in Cape Town, and he hopes you will see proper to maintain the following appointments. He much regrets the time and his present indisposition do not allow him to communicate the confidential remarks upon your captains personally in the usual manner, and begs you will forgive this hasty scribble. He passed a half-sheet of paper, folded and sealed, and said, "I believe that's all, sir, apart from Mr. Shepherd's message. He says that since you'll need a Commodore secretary, he begs to recommend his cousin, Mr. Peter. Mr. Peter has been several months on this station and is thoroughly au courant. He's in Simonstown at the moment, rode over with me if you choose to see him."
"I should be happy to see Mr. Peter," said Jack, strongly aware of the importance of these civilities, of the importance of good relations throughout the squadron. Decency required Jack to refresh the flag lieutenant. Decency required the flag lieutenant to see his share of the bottle out within 10 minutes, in order to leave the new Commodore free for the innumerable tasks awaiting him. But although the young man did his best, no period of Jack's life had ever passed so slowly. When Mr. Forster had gone at last, Jack summoned Johnson and said, "I wish you joy of your commission, Mr. Johnson. Here it is. The Admiral has confirmed your acting order, and I'm very sure you deserve it." He handed over the precious document, even more precious perhaps to Johnson than his pendant was to Jack, certainly less loaded with responsibility, and both to cut short the flood of thanks and to gain a few minutes, he said, "Pray be so good as to send the boatswain as soon as possible." While to the boatswain he said, "Mr. Fellows, I don't suppose we have a broad pendant in the colour chest. If not, I should be obliged if you would have one run up directly."
"Aye, aye, sir," said the boatswain, trying to suppress a grin. "Broad pendant it is."
Out of piety, a dread of offending fate by presumption, Jack had never ordered one to be made. He'd felt the temptation very strongly. He'd longed to cherish it in private. But he had waited until it should be certain. On the other hand, the Boadiceers had turned the matter over in their heads well north of the line, ferreting about and fitting odd scraps together. They'd become convinced of the need for such an object, and it had been lying by these last 4,000 miles. The boatswain hurried off forward. Jack broke the Admiral's seal and read, "Captain Pym of the Sirius is a thoroughly reliable, conscientious officer, but wanting in initiative. Captain Corbett of the Nereid, though he keeps an excellent discipline and is of outstanding value as a fighting commander, has a tendency to irascibility that is to be regretted. He is on bad terms with Captain Lord Clomfort of the Otter, and the two should not be sent together on detached service if it can be avoided. Lord Clonfert has distinguished himself recently in several minor actions of a most dashing nature, and he, like Captain Corbett, has a considerable acquaintance with the waters off Reunion and Mauritius." The confidential remarks told Jack perhaps rather more about the Admiral than the captain's, but he'd scarcely formulated this reflection before Fellows came hurrying back, bearing the beautiful pendant in his arms. Jack looked at it with an affectation of detachment that could scarcely have deceived his daughters, far less the boatswain. "Thank you, Mr. Fellows," he said. "Pray put it on the locker, and then ask the doctor with my compliments whether he can spare a moment." He was drawing on the breeches of his best full-dress uniform when Stephen walked in. "I thought you might like to see something new," he said, adding, not without pride, "Ex Africa Surgit Semper Aliquid Novi, Novi, eh?"
"To what do you refer?"
asked Stephen, gazing about the cabin. "Cannot you see anything that strikes you dumb with awe? The mark of a living Commodore, very nearly the most exalted being on the face of the earth? The ornamental cloth?
Oh, that! I'd understood you to say something new. That cloth I saw daily in the bosun's cabin when his bowels were disturbed long ago. I took it for a sign of his office, or perhaps the banner of some bosun's guild. Then, feeling obscurely that he hadn't quite fulfilled his friend's expectations, he added, "But it's an amazingly handsome flag, upon my honour, and so neatly sewn. I dare say you'll hang it up presently. I'm sure it'll do us all great credit, the pretty thing." If there had been little secrecy aboard the frigate, there was even less in the squadron. No one had failed to remark the flag lieutenant's arrival, nor his prolonged stay in the Boadicea, nor the subsequent desertion of the flagship by a troop of the Admiral's servants and followers, nor yet Captain Aubrey's passage across the harbour. When the swallow-tailed pendant broke out at the Raisinab's masthead, therefore, not a ship or vessel present let a second go by before starting the 13-gun salute due to the man it symbolised. The salutes merged with one another and with their echoes, filling the bay with a sullen roar, a cloud of smoke that drifted over Jack as he stood there on the poop, not directly looking at his pendant, but feeling its presence with, oh, such intensity. The moment his thunderous reply was done, he returned to the signal lieutenant and said, "All captains, Mr. Swiney." He received them in the Admiral's great cabin. The Raisinab was not the Hibernia, nor yet the Victory. But still, this was a noble room, full of dappled, reflected light. And as they filed in, their blue and white and gold made it look nobler still. Pym of the Sirius came first, a big man, as tall as Jack and fatter. His congratulations were as frank and unreserved as his fine, friendly, open face, and Jack's heart warmed to him. Corbett followed, a small, dark, round-headed man, whose set expression of determined, angry authority was now softened into a look of the deference and the pleasure proper to this occasion. He had fought several most creditable actions in the West Indies, and in spite of Bondon, Jack looked at him with respect, with hopeful anticipation, too. Corbett's good wishes were almost as cordial as Pym's, although there might have been the slightest hint of resentment, of merit and local knowledge passed over. But in any event, they were far more hearty than Clonfert's formal, "Allow me to offer my felicitations, sir." "Now, gentlemen," said Commodore Aubrey, when this stage was over, "I'm happy to tell you that the squadron is to proceed to sea with the utmost dispatch. I should therefore be obliged for a statement of each ship's readiness, her condition, not a detailed statement, you understand, that can come later, but a general notion. Lord Clonfert, the sloop I have the honour to command is always ready to put to sea," said Clonfert. That was mere rodomontade. No ship was always ready to put to sea unless she never used up any water, stores, powder or shot. And the Otter had just come in from a cruise. They all knew it. Clonfert as well as any, once the words were out of his mouth. Without allowing the awkward pause to last more than a moment, however, Jack went straight on, receiving a more rational account from Pym and Corbett, from which it appeared that the Sirius, their well-found in general, badly needed careening, and that she was having great trouble with her water tanks, newfangled iron affairs that had been wished on her in Plymouth and had leaked amazingly. "If there's one thing that I detest more than anything," said Captain Pym, staring round the table, "it's innovations." The Sirius had rummaged her hold to come at the tanks, so even with the best will in the world and working double tide, she could scarcely be ready for sea before Sunday. The Nereid, though apparently fit to sail the moment she had filled her water, was really in a much sadder way,
She was old, as the Commodore knew, and according to Captain Corbett's carpenter, her naval futtocks could be removed with a shovel. While she was certainly iron-sick fore and aft, if not amidships too. But far worse than that, she was shockingly undermanned. Captain Corbett was 63 hands short of his complement. A shocking figure. Jack agreed that it was a very shocking figure, to be sure. But let's hope that the next homeward-bound Indiaman to put in will solve the difficulty with 63 prime hands and a few supernumeraries. You're forgetting, sir, that ever since their disagreement with government about the running of the colony, the company's ships no longer touch at the Cape. Very true, said Jack, with a covert glance at Clonfert. He covered his lapse by saying that he should visit their ships in the course of the afternoon, when he would hope to see their detailed statements of condition, and suggested that they should now discuss some claret that he had taken from a Frenchman on his way down. The last of the Lafitte appeared, together with something in the farinaceous line from the Boadicea's galley. "Capital wine," said Pym.
"As sound as a nut," said Corbett. "So you found a Frenchman, sir?"
"Yes," said Jack, and he told them about the Ebe. It was not much of an action, but the mere talk of banging guns, the hyena restored to the list, the prize neatly salvaged, caused the formal atmosphere to relax. Reminiscence flowed with the claret. Comparable actions and old shipmates were called to mind. Laughter broke out. Jack had never served with either Pym or Corbett, but they had many acquaintances in common throughout the service. When they'd spoken of half a dozen, Jack said, "You knew Heneage Dundas in the West Indies, of course, Captain Corbett," thinking that this might jog his mind.
"Oh, yes, sir," said Corbett, "but no more."
"That will not wash, however," said Jack within, and aloud, "Lord Clonfert, the bottle stands by you." All this time, Clonfert had been sitting silent. A shaft of light falling on his star sent a constellation of little prismatic dots flashing high. Now, as he leant forwards to the bottle, they all swept down. He filled his glass, passed the bottle on, and, moved perhaps by some notion of repairing his unpleasant relationship with Corbett, and possibly at the same time of winning an ally in this meeting where he could not but feel at a disadvantage, he said, "Captain Corbett, a glass of wine with you."
"I never drink a glass of wine with any man, my lord," replied Corbett.
"Captain Corbett," said Jack quickly, "I was astonished to learn about the Russian brig lying inside the Nereid, and even more astonished when the Admiral told me that her captain had served under you."
"Yes, sir. He was in the Seahorse when I had her, serving as a volunteer to learn our ways. And he picked them up pretty well, I must confess. His people are scarcely what we should rate ordinary, and I dare say he'll knock some ship into them in time. They have a fine sense of discipline in those parts. 1,000 lashes are not uncommon, I believe."
The talk ran on about the unfortunate Diana, her sailing from the Baltic on a voyage of discovery at a time of peace between England and Russia, her arrival all unsuspecting in Simonstown to learn that war had been declared, her curious status, her curious build, her people's curious ways ashore. 8 bells struck. They all stood up. Jack detained Corbett for a moment and said, "Before I forget it, Captain Corbett, my coxswain and some other men are aboard the Nereid. Here, I've jotted down their names. You'll oblige me by having them sent over."
"Certainly, sir," said Corbett. "Of course... But I beg you'll not think I intend the least disrespect if I venture to repeat that I am cruelly short-handed."
"So I understand," said Jack,
But I don't mean to rob you. Far from it. You shall have an equal number from the Boadicea, and I believe I may even be able to let you have a few more. We pressed some good men among the Abbe's prisoners.
I should be most uncommon grateful, sir, said Corbett, brightening at once, and I shall send your men back the moment I reach the ship.
It was with his own coxswain at his side, therefore, that the Commodore put off for his tour of the squadron.
This is like old times, Bondon, he said as they approached the Sirius.
Yes, sir. Only better,
murmured Bondon. And then, in answer to the frigate's hail, he roared, Pendant! In a voice to wake the dead. It didn't startle the Sirius, however. From the moment of Captain Pym's return, all hands had turned to, dinner cut short, grog gulped down, in order to give her an entirely artificial and fallacious appearance designed to make her appear what she was not. They'd done so with a will, being proud of their ship, and although there had been no time for any lavish repainting, the Sirius that the Commodore beheld was as unlike her workaday self as the concentrated effort of 287 men and several women, some regular, others less so, could make her. Seeing that she was virtually disemboweled because of her tanks, they hadn't been able to turn her into a larger version of a royal yacht, as they could have wished. But, apart from the pyramids of nameless objects on deck, decently shrouded with awnings and tarpaulins, she was very presentable, and Jack was pleased with what he saw. He didn't believe it, of course, nor was he expected to believe it. The whole thing, from the whitewashed coal in the galley to the blackened balls and the shot garlands, was a ritual disguise. Yet it had a relationship to the facts, and he gained the impression of a fine, steady ship in moderately good order, with competent officers and a decent crew largely composed of man-of-war's men. She'd been in commission these 3 years and more. Captain Pym had set up a splendid array of bottles and cakes in his cabin, and as Jack lowered Bath Bun, whose specific gravity somewhat exceeded that of platinum, he reflected that its consistency was in all likelihood a fair symbol of the ship. Steady, regular, rather old-fashioned, reliable, though perhaps not apt to set the Indian Ocean in a blaze. Next, the Nereide. She had had no real need to turn to in order to achieve the full effect that the Sirius had aimed at, yet from the mute, weary sullenness of her crew and the anxious, jaded, harassed look of her officers, every man Jack aboard had been hard at it, gilding the lily for this occasion. Jack liked a taut ship, and of course a clean ship, but the total perfection of the Nereid's vast expanse of brass alone oppressed him. He went through with his inspection, that being due to those who had toiled so hard and to so little purpose, but he made his tour of the silent, rigid frigate with no pleasure at all. His real business lay below, however, among the naval futtocks. And there, in the depths, with the captain, his nervous first lieutenant, and his nervous carpenter, he found that Corbett hadn't exaggerated greatly. Her timbers were indeed in a bad way. Yet, he reflected as he prodded about with a spike, the Simonstown surveyor might be right in saying that they would last another two or three seasons, whereas unless Jack was out in his reckoning, the rot on the upper deck would spread more rapidly than that. As a young fellow, a midshipman in those very waters, he had been disrated for misconduct, for venery, and turned before the mast. Infinitely against his will, he had been a foremast jack for 6 months. That ship's standard of spit and polish had been nothing remotely like the Nereid's, but she had had a tartar of a captain and a driving first lieutenant, and he knew to his cost just what it took in labour to produce even half this result. And those months, so wretched at first, and indeed most of the time,
had also given him something that few officers possessed, an intimate understanding of life at sea from the men's point of view, a comprehension from within. He knew their language, spoken and silent, and his interpretation of the looks he'd seen before coming below, the constraint, the veiled sideways glances, the scarcely perceptible nods and signs, the total lack of anything resembling cheerfulness, depressed him extremely. Corbett was a brisk man with figures, however. He produced his detailed statement of the Nereid's condition, neatly ruled in black and red, at the same time as his Madeira and sweet biscuits. "You're very well found in powder and shot, I see," Jack remarked, glancing over the columns. "Yes, sir," said Corbett. "I don't believe in flinging it into the ocean. Besides, your genuine recoil does so plough up the deck." "It does, and the Nereid's deck is a most remarkable sight, I must confess. But do you not find it answers to have your men handy with the guns, accurate at a distance?" "Why, sir, as far as my experience goes, it don't make much odds. I've always engaged yardarm to yardarm when they couldn't miss if they tried. But I don't have to tell you anything about close engagement, sir. Not after your action with the Cacafuego. Still, there is something to be said for the other school of thought. Something to be said for knocking away the enemy's sticks from a mile off and then lying athwart his oars," observed Jack mildly. "I'm sure you're right, sir," said Corbett, without the least conviction. If the Nereid had been as like a royal yacht as a man-of-war could very well be, the Otter, at first glance, was the yacht itself. Jack had never, in all his life, seen such a display of gold leaf. And rarely had he seen all shrouds and stays wormed with vermilion yarn, and the strops of the blocks covered with red leather. At second glance, it seemed perhaps a little much, touching on the showy, just as the perfection of tailoring on Clonfert's quarterdeck. Even the midshipmen had laced cocked hats, breeches, and Hessian boots with gold tassels. It had a hint of costume rather than of uniform about it. And as he stood there, Jack noticed, to his surprise, that Clonfert's officers appeared rather a vulgar set. They couldn't help their undistinguished faces, of course, but their stance, now too rigid, like tailor's dummies, now too lounging and easy by far, was something else again. So was their underbred open staring, their direct listening to what their captain had to say to him. On the other hand, no great perspicacity was required to see that the atmosphere aboard the Otter was as unlike that in the Nereid as possible. The lower-deck Otters were a cheerful, smiling crew, and it was clear that they liked their captain, while the standing officers, the boatswain, the gunner, and the carpenter, those essential pillars, seemed steady, valuable, experienced men. The Otter's decks, rigging, and gingerbread work had surprised him. Her cabin surprised him even more. Its not inconsiderable size was much increased by looking-glasses in gilt frames. These reflected a remarkable number of cushions piled up on a Turkish sofa, and the Arabian Nights were even more strongly called to mind by scimitars hanging on the bulkhead against a Persian carpet, a gilt mosque lamp swinging from the beam, and a hubble bubble. Among all this, the 2 12-pounders looked homely, brutish, drab, and ill at ease. The ritual offerings appeared, brought in by a black boy in a turban, and Jack and Clonfert were left alone. A certain awkwardness became manifest at once. With advancing years, Jack had learnt the value of silence in a situation where he didn't know what to say. Clonford, though slightly older in spite of his youthful appearance, had not. And he talked. These baubles were from his Syrian campaign with Sir Sidney, the lamp, a present from the Ghezar Pasha, the scimitar on the right from the Maronite Patriarch. He'd grown so used to Eastern ways that he couldn't do without his sofa. Wouldn't the Commodore sit down?
The Commodore had no notion of lowering himself to within inches of the deck. What could he do with his legs? And replied that he should as soon keep an eye on the Boadicea's boats as they pulled briskly between the arsenal and the frigate, filling her magazines and shot lockers with what he hoped would prove a most persuasive argument. Then the Commodore would surely taste a little of this Constantia and toy with an Aleppo fig. Clonfert conceived that they made an interesting combination. Or perhaps a trifle of this Botargo.
I'm infinitely obliged to you, Clonfert, said Jack, and I'm sure your wine is prodigious good. But the fact of the matter is that Sirius gave me a great deal of capital port and Nereid a great deal of capital Madeira. So what I should really prize beyond anything at this moment is a cup of coffee, if that's possible. It was not possible. Clonfert was mortified, chagrined, desolated. But he drank no coffee, nor did his officers. He really was mortified, chagrined, and desolated too. He had already been obliged to apologise for not having his statement of condition ready, and this fresh blow, this social blow, cast him down extremely. Jack wanted no more unpleasantness in the squadron than already existed, and even on the grounds of common humanity he didn't wish to leave Clonfert under what he evidently considered a great moral disadvantage. So, pacing over to a fine narwhal tusk leaning in a corner, he said, in an obliging manner, "This is an uncommonly fine tusk. A handsome object, is it not? But with submissions, I believe, horn is the proper term. It comes from a unicorn. Sir Sidney gave it to me. He shot the beast himself, having singled it out from a troop of antelopes. It led him a tremendous chase, though he was mounted on Hassan Bey's own stallion, 25 miles through the trackless desert. The Turks and Arabs were perfectly amazed. He told me they said they'd never seen anything like his horsemanship, nor the way he shot the unicorn at full gallop. They were astounded."
"I'm sure they were," said Jack.
He turned it in his hands and said with a smile, "So I can boast of having held a true unicorn's horn."
"You may take your oath on it, sir. I cut it out of the creature's head myself."
"How the poor fellow does expose himself," thought Jack, on his way back to the Raisonnable. He had had a narwhal tusk in his cabin for months, bringing it back from the north for Stephen Maturin, and he was perfectly acquainted with the solid heft of its ivory, so very far removed from horn. Yet Clonfert had probably thought that the first part was true. Admiral Smith was a remarkably vain and boastful man, quite capable of that foolish tale. Yet at the same time Admiral Smith was a most capable and enterprising officer. Apart from other brilliant actions, he'd defeated Bonaparte at Arques. Not many men had such grounds for boasting. Perhaps Clonfert was of that same strange build. Jack hoped so with all his heart. Clonfert might show away with all the unicorns in the world, as far as Jack was concerned, and lions too, so long as he also produced something like the same results. His meagre belongings had already come across from the Boadicea. They'd already been arranged by his own steward, as he liked them to be arranged, and with a contented sigh Jack sat easy in an old Windsor chair with arms, flinging his heavy full dress coat onto a locker. Killick didn't like seeing clothes thrown about. Killick would have to lump it. But Killick
who had dashed boiling water onto freshly ground coffee the moment the Raisonnable's barge shoved off from the Otter, was a new man. Once cross-grained, shrewish, complaining, a master of dumb and sometimes vocal insolence, he was now almost complacent. He brought in the coffee, watched Jack drink it, hissing hot with something like approval, hung up the coat, uttering no unfavourable comment, no rhetorical, "Where's the money going to come from to buy new epaulettes and all the bullions worn off, in consequence of being flung down regardless?" but carried on with the conversation that Jack's departure had interrupted.
You did say, sir, as how they had no teeth?
Not a sign of them, Killick, not a sign before I sailed.
Well, I'm right glad on it.
Producing a handkerchief with two massive pieces of coral in its folds, because this will help to cut 'em, as they say. Thank you, Killick, thank you kindly. Splendid pieces, upon my word. They shall go home in the first ship. Ah, sir, said Killick, sighing through the stern window. Do you remember that wicked little old copper in the back kitchen and how he roused out its flue, turning as black as chimney sweeps? That wicked little old copper will be a thing of the past when next we see the cottage, said Jack. The Abbe looked after that. And there will be a decent draught in the parlour too, if Godby knows his business. And them cabbages, sir, went on Killick in an ecstasy of nostalgia. When I last see him, they had but four leaves apiece. Jack! Jack! Cried Stephen, running in. I've been sadly remiss. You're promoted, I find. You're a great man. You're virtually an admiral. Give you joy, my dear, with all my heart. The young man in black clothes tells me you're the greatest man on the station after the commander-in-chief.
Why, I'm Commodore, as most people have the candour to admit, said Jack. But I did mention it before, if you recollect. I spoke of my pendant. So you did, Joy, but perhaps I didn't fully apprehend its true significance. I had a cloudy notion that the word Commodore, and indeed that curious little flag, were connected with a ship rather than with a man. I'm almost sure that we called the most important ship in the East India fleet, the ship commanded by the excellent Mr. Muffet, the Commodore. Pray explain this new and splendid rank of yours.
Stephen, if I tell you, will you attend?
Yes.
I've told you a great deal about the Navy before this, and you've not attended. Only yesterday I heard you give Farquhar a very whimsical account of the difference between the half-deck and the quarter-deck, and to this day I don't believe you know the odds between... At this point he was interrupted by the black-coated Mr. Peter, with a sheaf of papers, by a messenger from the General at Cape Town, and by Seymour, with whom he worked out a careful list of those men who could be discharged into the Nereid, either in the light of their own crimes or in that of the frigate's more urgent needs. And lastly, by the Commander-in-Chief's secretary, who wished to know whether his cousin Peter suited, to say that Admiral Bertie, now much recovered, sent his compliments, without wishing to hurry the Commodore in any way, the Admiral would be overjoyed to hear that he'd put to sea.
Well, now, Stephen, said Jack at last, this Commodore lark. In the first place, I'm not promoted at all. It's not a rank, but a post, and J. Aubrey doesn't shift from his place on the captain's list by so much as the hundredth part of an inch. I hold this post just for the time being. And when the time being is over, if you follow me, I go back to being a captain again. But while it lasts, I am, as who should say, an acting temporary unpaid rear admiral, and I command the squadron.
That must warm your heart, said Stephen. I've often known you chafe in a subordinate position.
It does. The word is like a trumpet. Yet at the same time, I shouldn't say this to anyone but you, Stephen, But it's only when you have an enterprise of this kind on your hands. An enterprise where you have to depend on others, that you understand what command amounts to. By others, you mean the other commanders, I take it. Sure, they are an essential factor that must be thoroughly understood. Pray open your mind upon them without reserve. Jack and Stephen had sailed together in many ships, but they had never discussed the officers. Stephen Maturin, a surgeon, had messed with them, and although he was the captain's friend, he belonged to the gunroom. The subject was never, never raised. Now the case altered. Now Stephen was Jack's political colleague and adviser, nor was he bound in any way to the other commanding officers. Let us begin with the Admiral. And, Jack, since we are to work openly together, we must speak openly. I know your scruples, and I honour them, yet believe me, brother, this is no time for scruples. Tell, do you look for full, unreserved support from Mr. Bertie? He's a jolly old boy, said Jack. And he's been as kind and obliging to me as I could wish. He confirmed my acting order for Johnson at once, a most handsome compliment. As long as all goes well, I make no doubt he'll back us to the hilt. Apart from anything else, it's entirely in his interest. But his reputation in the service... Well, in Jamaica they called him Sir Giles Overreach from the fellow in the play, you know. And he certainly overreached poor James. A good officer, mark you, though you don't see much farther through a brick wall than another man. He considered for a while before saying, "But if I made a mistake, I shouldn't be surprised to be superseded, nor have I stood between him and a plum. Though as things stand, I can't see how that could come about." "You have no very high opinion of his head, nor of his heart." "I shouldn't go so far as that. We have different ideas of what's good order in a ship, of course. Now, I shall tell you one thing that makes me uneasy about his sense of what is right. This Russian brig, she's an embarrassment to everybody. The Admiral wishes her away, but he'll not take the responsibility of letting her go. He'll not accept the responsibility of making her people prisoners either. Among other things, they would have to be fed with everything charged against him if government disapproved. So what he's done is to make the captain give his word not to escape and has left him lying there ready for sea. He's trying to starve Golovnin out by allowing no rations for his men. Golovnin has no money and the merchants will not accept bills drawn on Petersburg. The idea is that he'll break his word and disappear some dirty night when the wind's in the northwest. His word means nothing to a foreigner, said the Admiral, laughing. He wondered Golovnin hadn't gone off 6 months ago. He longed to be rid of him. He took it so much as a matter of course, didn't hesitate to tell it, thought it such a clever way of covering himself, that it made my heart sink. Stephen said, I've noticed that some old men lose their sense of honour, and will cheerfully avow the strangest act. What else affects your spirits now? Corbett, I dare say. In that case, the beadle within has quite eaten up the man. Yes. He's a slave driver. I don't say a word against his courage, mark you. He's proved that again and again. But by my book, his ship is in very bad order indeed. She's old, too, and only a 12-pounder. Yet with the odds as they are, I can't possibly do without her. What do you say to the captain of the Sirius? Pym? Jack's face brightened. Oh, how I wish I had three more Pyms in three more Siriuses. He may be no phoenix, but he's the kind of man I like. Three Pyms,
and there would be your band of brothers for you. I should have to do myself no violence keeping on terms with three Pims, or three Elliots, for that matter. Though he'll not be with us long, more's the pity. He means to invalid as soon as ever he can. As it is, I shall have to humour Corbett to some degree. And Clonfort. For without there is a good understanding in a squadron, it might as well stay in port. How I shall manage it with Clonfort, I can hardly tell. I mustn't get athwart his hawse if I can avoid it, but with that damned business of his wife, I'm halfway there already. He resented it extremely. Refused my invitation, which is almost unheard of in the service, previous engagement or not. And there was no previous engagement. This is an odd case, Stephen. When we talked about him some time ago, I didn't like to say I had my doubts about his conduct. An ugly thing to say about any man. But I had. And I wasn't the only one. Yet, maybe I wasn't as wise as I supposed. For although he still looks like a flash cove in a flash ship, he did distinguish himself up the Mediterranean with Admiral Smith. That, I presume, was where he came by his star. It's an order I've never seen. Yes, the Turks handed out quite a number, but they were thought rather absurd, and not many officers asked permission to wear them. Only Smith and Clonfort, I believe. And he's also carried out some creditable raids and cutting out expeditions in these waters. He knows them well, and he has a native pilot. The Otter draws little water, even less than the Nereid, so he can stand in among the reefs. That, according to Admiral Bertie, he might almost be setting up as a rival to Cochrane in the matter of distressing the enemy. Yes, I've heard of his enterprise, and of his ship's ability to go close to the shore. I shall no doubt have to be with him from time to time to be landed and taken off. But just now you spoke of the odds. How do you see them at present? Simply in terms of ships and guns, and only from the point of view of fighting at sea, they're rather against us. Then if you allow for the fact that we shall be more than 2,000 miles from our base while they're in their home waters, with supplies at hand, you might say they're in the nature of 3 to 5. In the Channel or the Mediterranean, I should put it nearer even, since we are at sea all the time in those parts and they're not. But their heavy frigates have been out the best part of a year now. Plenty of time to work up their crews, given competent officers. And upon the whole, the French officers are a competent set of men. But all this is very much up in the air. There's so many unknowns in the equation. For one thing, I know nothing of their captains, and everything depends on them. Once I catch sight of them at sea, I shall be able to reckon the odds more accurately. Once you've had a brush with them, you mean? No, once I've seen them, even hull down on the horizon. Could you indeed judge of their abilities at so remote a view? Of course, said Jack a little impatiently. What a fellow you are, Stephen. Any sailor can tell a great deal from the way another sailor sets his jib, or goes about, or flashes out his stunsels, just as you could tell a great deal about a doctor from the way he whipped off a leg. Always this whipping off of a leg. It's my belief that for you people the whole noble art of medicine is summed up in the whipping off of a leg. I met a man yesterday, and he was so polite as to call on me today, quite sober, who would soon put you into a better way of thinking. He's the Otter's surgeon. I should probably have to cultivate his acquaintance in any event for our own purposes, since the Otter is, as you would say, an inshore brig. But I don't regret it now that I've met him. He is, or was, a man of shining parts. But to return to our odds, you would set them at 5 to 3 in favour of the French? Something of that kind. If you add up guns and crews and tonnage, it's a great deal worse. But of course I can't really speak to the probability until I see them. Yet although I've sent 100 boadiceers to lend a hand aboard the Sirius, and although I know Pym is doing his utmost to get her ready for sea, our own ship has to take in 6 months' stores.
and I should love to careen her too, the last chance of a clean bottom for God knows how long. I can't see how we can sail before Saturday's tide. I shall keep the people hard at it and harry the arsenal until they wish me damned, but apart from that there's nothing I can do. There's nothing that the Archangel Gabriel could do. So what do you say to some music, Stephen? We might work out some variations on Be Gone, Dull Care.